once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is the 25th of January, 2020, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call.
If it's not, then you're hopefully talking from the future or listening from the future. Because if you're listening from the past, then you know
cool.
the future.
That would really be cool.
Let's tell them let's disclose first and then tell them all the secrets about the future, what's happened this week.
Well, the telephone number in here, I think, is 254-773-1400. I called yesterday and it rang. We didn't get a deadline. So somebody give us a call and tell us whether it's correct, whether it's working or not.
The IRS was not involved if you didn't get a deadline.
That's true. That's true. Or your book publisher. Let's see what else. So we need to tell you that I always forget what we're supposed to disclose here.
Okay. So we're an SEC registered investment
advisor.
Oh,
that's right. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that neither is approved nor disapproved by the SEC because they never approve or disapprove. Well, they disapprove stuff, but they never approve anything. And it's not working. So 773-1400 is not working.
But the message is in Spanish.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Then it's 771-2463 is
That's
the telephone
right.
number to call in here. 771-2463. And if I memorize it, you should be able to memorize it. Let's see. What else?
You memorize stuff that most people would not want to memorize, though. Like
the names of books.
Names of books and places and things. And okay, so what else do we've got? The SEC doesn't
approve or disapprove.
They don't approve or disapprove of us in any way, shape, or form.
But they do regulate us.
Yes.
And
it's kind of like saying, well, does the FBI approve of you? Well, they don't really get a say in whether they approve of us or not, but they definitely regulate.
They definitely could disapprove. So we have to be careful what we say.
Correct.
Or do. And we advertise on KTEM. They don't pay us, but we don't pay them for this radio program.
We do advertise on...
For the radio program.
For the radio program on the station. So how's that for weird?
It's weird to the nth degree.
Yes.
And let's see. The information we present on here is from sources we consider to be reliable, deemed to be...
It's very deemed.
Yeah, it's got a deem.
Deemable.
James Deem. We deem to be reliable and accurate. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness or accuracy of any information we present.
See, you memorized that.
If you have received this message in error, please immediately send it back and erase the message.
Yes, there we go. And let's see.
Close cover before striking.
This is educational material, not advice.
That's true.
Okay. We have a caller on 771-2463. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I would just like to inform you that the 773-1400 line does not work. Yeah. Therefore, callers, call the 2463 line.
771-2463. That's right. Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Is that you just called in to tell us?
If I have anything to say, I mean to ask you, I'll call back later.
Okay.
All right.
So you called in to tell us that you called in.
I called in to tell you that the 773-1400 line does not work.
Okay. So let's give that line out a few more. No, let's not do that. Thank you for the call.
We're not the government. We are not allowed to do that.
We'll just repeat repeatedly that the full-on number with a statement that it doesn't work. No, we'll give you the right one. 254-771-2463. And amazingly... we've got another caller on 254-771-2463.
You're getting good at saying that now.
I'm saying it a lot because otherwise we're going to get a lot of people complaining about a Spanish message that the line doesn't work. So caller on 771-2463, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. If it wasn't for that last caller calling in, there would be no way that I could have asked you this question. So thank you, that last caller, for giving that phone number out.
We should give you each other's number.
Y'all are so good, y'all are so good at numbers and everything, and I was just kind of curious, it's kind of a long shot, but is there any possible way y'all could give me the numbers to the lottery so I could get me a big bank account right quick?
Sure. Yeah, we can give you the winning numbers to the lottery for any lottery that's had winning numbers in the past.
There you go.
Our
past performance is no guarantee of future lottery winnings. So.
Hey, well, you know, I was just going to say that I enjoy listening to y'all, and I think the little humor every once in a while just pays off for the tribute to keep it going. So you have yourself a good day, sir.
All right. You too. Take care.
John Sharp, who was the comptroller of the state of Texas at the time the lottery came into existence, made a speech to a group I was in several years ago, and I asked him about it. And he said the odds of winning the lottery, it can be calculated very simply. If you took bottle caps, if you remember what bottle caps
are. Or pennies.
Or pennies. And you laid them in a line three wide from Texarkana to El Paso.
Uh-huh.
Your chances, one of those pennies or one of those bottle caps has you win on it. And you're paying for all the other ones.
Well, he missed a greater statistic.
What's that?
He'd be put in jail for littering. So statistically, you will
know.
Go to prison, which,
not,
you know,
not
that's
for
free
pennies,
room and board.
But not for pennies.
Not
no,
for pennies.
I don't think that's considered
Is that
litter.
Considered littering when you put government property on government property?
I don't think so.
All right. So we have another caller on 771-2463. Go ahead. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. There's been a lot of mergers in the last few years, and one of the benefits that everybody says to a merger is synergy and goodwill. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal that the Financial Accounting Standards Board is considering how they account for goodwill, whether to do annual tests or write it down a portion every year. What exactly is goodwill, and how would you calculate that for a financial sheet? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. You just didn't ask an easy question. Let me answer the first part of the question really easily.
What is goodwill? It's
goodwill.
A place where you take old clothes.
It's a thrift store. No, yeah. It is that. But goodwill as a thrift store is not what we're talking about here. If you read the headline, the headlines that come out on the subject very often, it sounds very disparaging to this very nice charity that helps a lot of people. What's the problem? Okay. When you're valuing a company, business valuation is wonky. Let me tell that and say that it is weird. One of the pieces that is valued in the worth of a company, and it's valued in the same way for small companies as big companies, it may not be considered in the bottom line price in either case. So what did I just say there? That was about as confusing as it gets. As a method of valuation, it's only apparent in what's called the book value. The book value is the balance sheet of all properties and debts, and one of the properties is what people think about that company. So if you think about the number of stickers on the back of Ford trucks of trademark infringing stickers, I'll have you know, Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes urinating on the Chevy sign. All the people that have those stickers are likely to buy Ford. What would you think? You think that's a reasonable statement?
Or they want to buy Calvin and Hobbes, I'm not sure.
Right. Well, no, this is not a Calvin and Hobbes licensed item, so I don't know. So what does that say? It says that, and if we look at the statistics on people that buy General Motors, Chevy, when they buy Ford, if you're talking about a pickup truck, and now let's move to Toyota as well, you get a very high statistical number of repeat buyers. They go back and buy it again. Do you know anybody that's done that?
One.
Or two. Or dozens.
One for sure, though.
Right. So that concept is, how do you value that? You've got a customer base that's very loyal. And how would you value that in a coffee shop, a local coffee shop that has you know, every group of early morning meters in the little town or in the district or in the block area that come in every day, rain or shine, and drink coffee. How do you value that? You can value the stream of income, that's separately, but that's discounted almost all the time. The stream of income that people get in a restaurant or in a real estate company is discounted because they don't know how much of it is due to growth, how much of it is due to repeat customers. Goodwill is where that is attempted to be resolved. And there is no final judgment on how to value that. There are lots of ways to value it.
Let me give you an example of goodwill that you, if you, particularly if you're like me and you like to wear hats.
Okay. I do like to wear hats.
Stetson has not made hats in decades.
But we still call those hats Stetson.
Right. Resistol bought Stetson decades ago. Now, their hat making facility was probably not even part of the deal.
Yeah.
So what they did is they bought the name Stetson, and their sales went up because they made hats and they put the word Stetson inside right. it because Stetson had a reputation.
Brand recognition.
Had this reputation for making quality hats, and it was associated with Texas and legend and all kinds of things like that. So when Stetson was sold, the major value in Stetson wasn't the hat-making machines and the real estate and everything else that they owned, which really wasn't worth a lot.
Right.
What was worth a lot was the name Stetson. And so Stetson got branded on pants, it got branded on shirts, and you notice it's gradually gone away. The question is, how fast does that deteriorate? And the only way to find out.
And what's it worth at any given time?
What is it worth is in a free market, in an arm's length engagement, in other words, nobody's trying to bend anybody else's arm.
At least not in the wrong direction.
Right.
Did you mean twist?
In a fair, voluntary engagement, what would somebody pay for that name? And that's a hard thing to determine.
Right. Another one. Kleenex.
Right.
When somebody says, give me a tissue, that's a relatively, at least in this area of the United States, it's relatively new. For a long time, people said, just give me a Kleenex. That's brand recognition. What's the value of brand recognition? You can tarnish a brand, which definitely causes the value of a company to drop. And when I say it's only apparent in book value, it's because the market doesn't value the company in a statistical way generally. So the name brand value of Stetson was in the stock price of the company that owned it. Who was the one that bought it again?
Resistol.
Okay, so Resistol's price went up. But it didn't go up in a statistical parity with what somebody thought the value of the goodwill of Stetson was. It went up with what the market thought the value of that was.
In other words, a free market system. And there's a lot of things that you buy today that have a brand name on them that are no longer owned by whoever created the brand name.
Right. In fact, most of them.
And it becomes a little bit complex because if the company that bought the brand name doesn't milk it and basically wear it out and put it on all kinds of things that are junk, then there's a lot of value in it. If they continue to make high quality goods with that brand name, the brand name actually appreciates in value. So the goodwill goes up. But the trick is trying to figure out whether it's – and the only way to do that, by the way, is surveys.
Right. And that's where you've got people's opinions. Another part of the question or part of the description before the question is something that I wanted to talk about today anyway. Mergers and acquisitions, M&A. There's a large number of them going on. For firms like ours, this is the seventh year in a row of absolute record numbers of mergers and acquisitions in that type of firm. Financial companies are merging all the way up to the point where they're so big that the Justice Department says, no, you can't do it. He said some things about synergies and about being able to use each other's equipment in a way that's more appropriate. There's a lot of cases where mergers cause more expenses. They're not always a win for both companies. In fact, a lot of times one company will win and the other one will lose in those things. And that's the majority of the time. Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter.
Dean Witter kind of went away.
It's what happened to Dean Witter. That's the sort of thing, and you can say that about most mergers that happen. One of the companies slowly goes away or quickly goes away. And there's other cases where companies merge into areas that are outside of their expertise, and the company who had that expertise goes away, and now they have this thing that used to be profitable that they, that one of the companies did, that is now not profitable anymore because nobody knows how to do it because that group of people left. That's true in tech companies. It's true in food creation companies. If you're talking about just your staples type thing, Heinz, and then you just do some research on what happened with Heinz. You can look at what happened with Budweiser when they were purchased. Their Budweiser is no longer an American company. It's a German company. Well, Germans are good at beer. And they're still profitable, but they're profitable in a very different way, not profitable in the same areas that they were. So mergers and acquisitions are happening, and they tend to happen in roaring bull markets, especially get really, really high toward the end of the roaring bull market. And when you throw in a corporate tax cut, there's a lot of it going on. Why does a corporate tax cut enter into this? This is where we can have some more dialogue rather than monologue. Corporation didn't have to pay taxes that they normally had to, which led to a larger amount of cash on hand. We've talked on the program for years now about stock buybacks that have been happening because of the tax cut at the end of 2017. Companies have a bunch of money. They're buying back their own stocks. Sometimes they're not buying their own stock. Sometimes they're buying another company. So mergers and acquisitions tend to happen when there's a lot of cash on hand in corporations. And they tend to slow down productivity at both places for at least a couple of years right afterwards, because they've got to figure out how to integrate all what they're doing together to get more efficient about it. And sometimes they never get more efficient.
The objective, the stated objective when there's a merger and acquisition, is to combine the administrative functions of the companies, the two companies. One administrative section or division is less expensive to operate than two. That's the theory. The problem, the mergers and acquisitions are okay by definition, but when you throw one word in there, they have a tendency to get into deep trouble, and the word is leveraged.
Yeah.
In other words, if the company buying, if let's say KKR or
let's use a really good example, Sears and Kmart.
Yes.
We know that the crash and burn has finally happened in that particular merger.
Well, it's happened multiple times.
Yeah,
Sears keeps going bankrupt. Well, that's an example of how goodwill goes away, too, because Sears used to be a name with tremendous goodwill. They had
lifetime guarantee. Yeah. Our lifetime, not yours.
Frankly, I have bought some Craftsman tools and found out that they didn't work any better than any other tool. What's worse, they wore out quicker. And when I went back to try to say I need this replaced because it's a Craftsman tool, they said, well, I'm sorry, you're beyond the one-year warranty, or you're beyond the 90-day warranty. But Craftsman was associated with a lifetime warranty on their tools, which may be one of the reasons the Sears went out of business.
Well, yeah, they cut corners on quality there.
But the point is,
kept the warranty.
It was a leveraged buyout by a hedge fund. And they milked goodwill.
And before that,
goodwill.
It was Kmart attempting to buy Sears and Sears turning around and buying Kmart and then selling all the property that Kmart sat on because both of them were defunct. And then a hedge fund came in and borrowed a bunch of money and bought Sears with no real idea to how to make it profitable again.
And it's been, and if you've been in a Sears store, they generally were run, before they went
before
bankrupt
they were gone.
This last time, you could see that they were run down. They had a limited supply of stuff on the shelves. Paint was peeling.
Yeah, there were water stains in the ceiling tiles.
And what happened was, and this does happen unfortunately quite frequently, a vulture fund came in, bought it up, and milked the goodwill out of it.
Yep.
And that's something you need to really be aware of.
You also need to look at who made money in the deal, because the management of the hedge fund definitely made money all through that proposition, while the investors in the hedge fund wound up eating their shirts.
Eating their shirts?
Yes. It's a lot of roughage.
Not losing
fiber
their shirts?
In there. Well, I'm just going to mix some metaphors. That's all.
Okay.
It was eating hats.
They ate the losses.
And losing their shirts. So
okay.
It's better than losing your hat, which nobody wants that. Nobody wants to see what we have under our hats.
Hmm. I got to think
about
that.
What we don't have under our hats.
Anyway, it's all pretty complicated. You know, there's a bottom line here that's kind of interesting. Accounting, particularly valuation accounting, is somewhat of a fiction, but it's a fiction that all of the accountants get together each year and agree on.
They're the experts, as are we. I have done business valuations. It's a good baseline to start a negotiation. That's what business valuation is about. If someone's coming in to buy and you say, this is what we're worth, you can do it for yourself. This is my net worth. Okay, that's great. But if you are an enterprising person with a good job, is your net worth growing or shrinking? That's something that's not in a net worth calculation.
And you can figure this out rather quickly. If you buy a house and you make improvements to the house, you spruce up the, you redesign the kitchen and renovate it and rebuild the kitchen, and you put a back porch on the house, you can keep up with how much you paid for the house plus all the money you put into the house for there was improvements, not maintenance, just improvements. And you can add it up and say the house is worth this much money. And on paper, particularly if you do depreciation correctly, on paper, that's accurate. However, the house is actually worth
what someone's willing to pay for it.
Exactly what somebody is willing to buy it for.
Yeah. And here's another example. Using a simple, just use your house concept. How could goodwill get involved there? We're like, with a house? How does goodwill get involved with a house? The house just got a roof. It's got walls. No. What if it's the house that was used as the set and the filming outside for the Brady Bunch? Well, suddenly you get extra hundreds of thousands of dollars added to the price of the house. That has nothing to do with the square footage or any of the rest of it. But wait, what about the red brick building that was used for the Cosby Show? For a long time, you got hundreds of thousands extra on that one.
Not anymore.
Goodwill went away.
And the other thing that goodwill has to do with is your house is an example of how goodwill works. All that has to happen is the crime rate go up in your local neighborhood, and the goodwill on your house drops. So your house is still the same house. It has the same bricks or stone or wood in it that it had before.
And there's
the same number. But they say there's so many square feet in the house. I have looked all through our house trying to find those square feet. I have never found a square foot in there yet. But same number of square feet it had, and it will then decline in value while houses elsewhere are going up. A new school can go in that has high quality in the vicinity of your house, and the goodwill value of your house goes up because there's a school nearby.
And then there's badwill. So the Polanski house in L.A., you know, this is an amazing director married to a beautiful actress. And then the Mansons happened. Nobody wants to live there anymore. And then Polanski had to flee to France because he's doing bad things with little girls. Badwill is a very, very real thing in the market. And Sears has badwill right now. Here's another one. I happen to be involved in part of the negotiating process. Get this. Hold on. I'm not breaking any privacy rules in doing this. For the defunct remains of MySpace.com. And the company that I was giving advice to in the process, I'm saying, yeah, don't pay too much for this. You're not really getting what you used to would have gotten.
Used to would have gotten. That's a technical term.
This is a technical valuation term.
Used to would have gotten.
I tend to translate
for neutral,
people.
Though.
Yeah. Yeah, it is carbon neutral at this point.
And of the woulda.
Just flew out of my mind. Celebrity guy, and I've met him a couple of times. You wouldn't know who he is. He was one of the lead singers in NSYNC and once dated Britney Spears. He was in, you would know him now, the movie about Facebook.
I didn't see the movie.
No, okay. Facebook. You wouldn't know who he was. Oh, man, why? My brain just went fried. But one of the companies that he was
in. Anybody after Ronald Reagan is, I'm kind of blank on
him. he was one of the major investors in the company that wound up buying MySpace, which did not benefit them at all. They wound up having to deal with some old lawsuits that MySpace hadn't dealt with yet and hadn't taken that into consideration. Old lawsuits are a very definable value around badwill. It's really hard to define the value of goodwill. So that was a long-winded answer to what sounded sort of like a simple question, but it's a really good concept. Holding that one, value is as much goodwill, badwill in a lot of cases as it is anything else. And here's an example. Louis Vuitton. If you have a Louis Vuitton purse and it's absolutely genuine.
If I have a Louis Vuitton purse.
You are going to be
a little strange.
A little strange.
Right.
You could do it.
Right.
They are not the cheapest purses. They're made out of the same material a lot of times as other purses. But they have embossed on them, all over it, the initials of Louis Vuitton. Suddenly it's worth a lot more money. Other people can put those same initials on there and get sued because the trademark has value. It's a recognized value, and that's how intellectual property is one of my favorite subjects. And goodwill is a big part of intellectual property. The true thing about intellectual property is you never know what your idea is worth, even after it's making you money. Because your idea is worth what other people's idea of your idea is worth. How's that for weird?
Yeah.
But I've just described economics probably simpler and a more easily understood way than going into all of the technical details of the formulas to do it. Because the formulas only make sense so that you can give someone a document that they can show to the person that is trying to buy their company and say, well, I disagree with your opinion of my value because see here, an expert has written down these numbers using these complicated formulas that mean it's worth this. And that's all it is.
Except, well, let's talk about real market values, okay?
Okay, let's
but
do
not
it.
Not real estate.
Not real estate. Although we could get into that too.
Well, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, which is our preferred, not necessarily favorite, but preferred indicator of what's going on in the stock market, fell 1.03% this week to close at 3295.47. Now, why is that significant? Because it hit a record, an intraday record.
On the upside?
On Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I think it was Wednesday. Wednesday. And then it started falling, and it began to fall faster and faster. The Dow, which had plowed through 29,000 and was still climbing on Wednesday, suddenly started down. And why? Because there's a virus in China, which shows what a globally interconnected world we have. Now, there's two cases of it in the United States, people
there's
who came
cases
from Wuhan.
In Europe. As of today, there's a case for somebody who hasn't been outside the country and hasn't been in extreme contact with anyone. But now we're talking about less than the number of people as fingers on my hand in a country with a 330 million population.
And this is things that affect markets. The potential is there for the virus to shut down global communications and global transportation. Wuhan, for example, which is a seaport,
mm-hmm.
is no longer, the Chinese government has blocked freighters and tankers from actually docking there. And then the price of oil dropped at the same time for exactly the same reason.
People are going to be afraid to get on airplanes.
And there's a concern that there will be a reduced demand for airplanes, for shipping, a lot of things that use oil. So this is an interesting, we're in a very globally connected world. We've had so few people, I was looking at the number of people who've died so far this year on highways in Texas, and it's multiples of the number of people who've died from this virus.
Yeah.
But we are so scared of that virus right now, the instant communication, that because there's no cure for it right now, there's no vaccine for it, that the stock market, this huge, powerful stock market in the United States drops 1% just because of a virus that popped up. Now, why is that important? It's important because when we're looking at the stock market right now, it's been rising dramatically, rose dramatically in the fourth quarter and accelerated. It rose more in December than it did in the other 2 months of the quarter. And it has continued to rise into this year. And as we've written in the newsletter, that rise is completely separated from the underlying fundamentals. It's rising because it's rising, and I think a lot of people are investing in the stock market because the price is going up at this point.
We'll probably know in April about traffic, roadway deaths in Texas for 2019. But 2018, there were 3,639 people killed on the roadways or right after an accident in Texas. That's a lot of people. And
there have been 95 killed so far this year, according to the sign I saw on the
right. And that's delayed by some time. So that may have been just in the first couple of weeks of January. Well, it had to be in the first couple of weeks of January. So this concept of there's a great book on this subject. It's called the Culture of Fear. We're generally afraid of things that are not the right things to be afraid of. We're afraid of the coronavirus. And it's causing people not to travel to Hawaii. It's causing people not to travel to Colorado. But we're not afraid, and not only afraid, it's so normal to hear about someone that died in a traffic accident. We know lots. Everybody that's listening knows people that died in traffic accidents. Unless you're really, really young and sheltered. So, how many people do you know that have died of the flu? Well, I can clearly say that everybody that's listening doesn't know someone who's died of the flu. And some of them might, but not everyone. The vast majority of people know someone that's died in a car accident. But it's so normal that we're not worried about it.
Did you read, by the way, where the coronavirus likely came from?
I did not. Where did it likely? I've heard a lot of ideas.
It was definitely in a market in Wuhan, an animal market.
Okay.
And it appears from the genetic makeup of the virus that it was endemic in bats.
I'm not going to make any, because I've seen so many causes of the virus in the last week. I'm not even going to.
This analysis, the genetics indicate that it came from bats. Infected snakes that are in close proximity to bats in this market, and because of the combination of the genetics of the snakes and the bat virus, the two together were able to make the jump to humans. So you have to have bats and snakes together for this to have originated in a form that could jump to humans and be communicable from human to human.
Well, here's the cure then. We need to get out and separate those bats and those snakes.
Well, this is the point I wanted to make. We're running along on a market that's running on air. Speculation that next year will be better than the previous year. And this happens at the end of bull markets.
And it may not be the total end. We may have another year of people doing this or more.
In all my reading, everybody that I read is saying there's very little chance of a bear market in 2020 because we look at all the factors that influence the market and they all look good. Except one, and that we can ignore.
Oh, yeah. The leading economic indicators is kind of an important one.
Well, but the manufacturing. As I say, manufacturing, we get along without manufacturing. As long as the consumer keeps spending and everything keeps running, there's no reason that we should fear a bear market or a down market in 2020. There's no reason we should fear a recession. But this is the point. Recessions are commonly triggered by something that nobody is aware of because it didn't even exist at the time they were looking.
Yeah.
Something, we call them black swans.
Yeah, you could call it whatever you want.
Something pops up, and that something that pops up triggers enough instability when you have a market that's on the edge, as this one is right now, that people stop buying. And as soon as people stop buying, that means there's more selling than buying, and the price goes down. And then people see the price going down, and they only bought it because the price was going up, and then they sell, and that caused the price to go down some more.
I'll give it an actual example of some of the key dominoes that started wobbling that caused other dominoes to fall in the Great Recession, and the failures that led up to the Great Recession. AIG, they had plenty of money on the books. It was just invested in different things that weren't that liquid. They were what did they have to do with the recession? Well, they were one of the largest companies supplying the default swap insurance on those collateralized mortgage obligations. They're the ones that are saying, you're sure these are AAA rated? All right, have some insurance on there. You don't even have to pay very much on it. This is good stuff. And they were getting some claims on their insurance. Imagine that. and at a higher rate than they expected. They still had lots of assets everywhere, but they weren't very liquid. So they got to the point where they were short on cash. Lots of assets, short on cash. They were about to have to lay off a lot of people because they didn't have enough money to make payroll. When they went to the Federal Reserve for a loan, and the Federal Reserve goes, are we allowed to make loans to insurance companies?
No.
Well, let's do it anyway, or this thing's going to go under. And if it goes under, if they can't pay their employees, all of that insurance is null and void. And it will cause everyone with collateralized mortgage obligations to eat their shirts. I'm going to keep that mixed metaphor.
Not to mention the fact that AIG's insurance was co-insured, was underwritten by these consortiums of other insurance companies.
And they had they were co-insuring others.
Right.
So all those others were linked together as well. So they said, hey, we gotta give these guys some cash or this isn't going to work. And AIG says, I don't know what's going on. The cash flow out is higher than we expected, but we're sure this is going to improve.
Now, this is something that's going on right now on Wall Street and in the New York money center banks. What was it, Friday, $70 billion went from the Fed to the money center banks. The day before, it was $45 billion, and they were really happy it was only $45 billion. And what's happening is the Fed is having to push liquidity into the markets. And he said,
just like what happened there.
What happens is we have a liquidity shortage over here, and nobody really understands. I've read a lot of theories on it.
We understand it now, looking backwards on what happened. But at the time, nobody really understood. Why is this not? This is AAA stuff. Why is it not paying?
People are trying to make educated guesses right now as to why we're having cash shortages in the New York money center banks. But it's when you have liquidity shortages that it starts to show that there's something out of balance in the system. And the way this, it's like Philip Corey, I think, originally said, don't know who's not wearing swimming trunks until the tide goes out. And we won't know who's not wearing swimming trunks in the corporate world and in the financial world until the tide goes out.
And I like that concept of the tide, because tides happen. Tides are a little bit more regular than downturns in the market. You could predict them by looking at the sky. It'd be nice if you could just look at this. I think that's what astrology is all about.
That's what it's all about.
Let's predict the market by looking at the sky. It works for the tides, so it should work for the markets, yes? You can spend some money on that if you'd like.
Anyway,
I don't think it's a good idea.
A little more about the markets. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell 13.4 basis points. A basis point, by the way, is 0.1%. And it closed out the week at 1.687%. And West Texas Intermediate crude joined in the pessimist party by falling 7.62% to close the week at 54.34. What is this important about?
Yeah, what is West Texas Intermediate crude anyway? I mean, is that like
it's
high school that's like an alternative school?
It's a benchmark of crude oil.
Where do you go to school? I go to West Texas Intermediate crude.
Then you must be wealthy. But it's a benchmark of the price of oil, and the price of oil has declined. The interest rate on the treasuries have declined. Now, by the way, when interest rates on treasuries decline, it means more people are buying treasuries. There's more volume of dollars buying treasuries than selling them. People buy when you've got a treasury note that's to last for 10 years, and it's only yielding roughly a little less than 1.7%. You know that people are not going there. By the way, that is a little lower than inflation is running right now. People are not going to tie up their money at a rate lower than inflation for 10 years unless they're afraid of something. In other words, they're leaving places where they could make more money because they're afraid.
It's a fear factor
that says things aren't as going to be as good as the future as they are currently.
That concept, way to think about it, is they're more concerned about return of principal rather than return on principal.
Will Rogers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've got to play some commercials.
We do.
So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The crazy phone number to call in here is 771-2463. That's 254-771-2463. And we'll be back on the other side of these commercials with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake McClure.
I messed that one up somehow. Not sure. Let's try that again. And we're back with the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. I don't know.
I said and. It threw you off.
We were talking about sweatshops and shops where they make sweat. It kind of messed my mind up.
We had heard in a recent report from Hawaii that artists, when you're buying art, you're also buying the sweat and the effort and the inspiration.
And the tears.
And the tears that go into it. And it's a beautiful statement, but my first response was, ew, I don't want to buy that sweat.
I don't want sweat and tears.
Where do they get that? A sweatshop? Should they get a sweatshop where they're making sweat? No.
Anyway, we talked about what happened in the market, that there's other things, lots of things economics to talk about. But again, the consensus among everything I read and the people that I'm listening to is that we're in a raging bull market and this will go on forever. And we've reached a permanent plateau of stock prices, which I credit to Irving Fisher, by the way, in 1929.
Yeah. So what that says is we're never there. And when people say it, that just means that they're about to be shocked at some point.
However, what didn't make headlines, as a matter of fact, I couldn't even find an article on it in the Wall Street Journal. I had to go straight to the conference board to find this information. The conference board index of leading economic indicators was released on January 23rd, and it was not headline. Nobody's paying much attention to it. The LEI, as it's called, declined 0.3% for December.
You say it in the newsletter.
But over the last 6 months,
crazy.
It's declined at an annualized negative 0.7% rate. Now, is that a guarantee we're going to have a recession? No. However, it means that there's a fair chance.
A real chance.
The issue is not that the declining leading economic indicators cause a recession, because they don't. But they are an indicator that the economy and the markets are running on momentum rather than new energy coming into the market and new things going in. We've been talking about for months now how business investment is lacking. It's been declining for over a year. And the money that normally would go into building factories and building equipment and buying new office equipment and so on just isn't there. Why? Well, it's been used to buy back stocks. Why is it being used to buy back stocks? Companies have reached the point where they're not convinced that further investment in their operations will cause larger profits in the future. And there's several very good reasons for that. One, obviously, is the uncertainty of the trade situation. But that's relatively minor. The big one, according to the surveys that that have been done among business owners and business decision makers, is the fact that it is so hard to find good employees. Because you can enlarge your capacity as a company. But unless you can find people to use that capacity, people who are willing to work and work long hours for a limited amount of pay, then you just wasted your money. And it's what's happening, and this is one of the reasons the stock market's been going up, is the companies have been using their profits from the tax cut, repatriation from overseas, and from their increased business that's going on in this economic boom that we're in, to buy back their own stock, which runs the stock market up.
And this is something that we've said quite a bit. The earnings of the S&P 500 are down for 2019.
Yes.
The average earning, now there's companies that have raised their earnings in that mix, but when you average it all together, this is part of what we look at, earnings are down in the same year that we had a extremely large jump in the value of the stock market. So what are they buying? Why is it that people are jumping in? Please don't get us wrong. We think these companies are good companies. There's some of them in there that are pretty bad, but the majority of the American economy is made of profitable, good companies. We're not saying that they're losing money. We're saying that the earnings are down. But their valuation increased while their earnings were down. That tends to mean that people are not looking at purchases in the same analytical way that they should if they were doing it professionally. I've just applied that same statement to the professionals in the market, because there's a lot of them that are caught up in this. It's really hard not to get caught up in euphoria, and it's really hard not to get caught up in the pessimism and total down in the dumps feeling in the bottom. And you got to stay out of both of those moods.
I read an interesting little quote that's apparently going around on Wall Street. The first part of it is bull markets climb a wall of worry, but they slide on a slope of hope.
Right. I don't
slide
think it's
on a slope of hope.
I don't
not,
think
but,
it's
but,
quite it, as definitive. It's really hard to even figure out what is sliding on a slope of hope.
In other
mean?
Words, when instead of worrying, when you run out of things to worry about and you just assume the market's going to go up,
I know
you
what
no
a,
longer worry.
I know what a wall of worry is.
You,
that makes sense
you're
to
buying
me.
On hope that things okay. will get better.
And what, when is, you, what is a slope of hope, though?
That causes it to slide downhill.
What if you wanted to climb? I'd rather climb a wall of hope than...
Yeah, but the bull markets climb a wall of worry, but they slide on a slope of hope.
I prefer the original quote. Thank you.
So do I, but I thought it was an interesting one that's going around.
Yeah. But the slope of hope. I think they just wanted to make a rhyme to fit. And the wall of worry doesn't, it's got W's on it, but it's not a rhyme.
The point I wanted to make here is that we are the lone voices that I could find at this point that are screaming. There's wolves out there. The rest of the investment community and the investment publications that we take are relentlessly optimistic. It was really, really hard this week to find anybody who wasn't just completely optimistic.
That terrifies us, and terrify in a very analytical sort of way. The flags are up. We're looking around saying, why is it nobody is worried? Behavioral studies on market behavior over the years have reinforced that statement that bull markets climb a wall of worry. When you stop being worried, when everybody stops being worried, that's when the bull market's over.
By the way, Irving Fisher, the same guy that said the permanent plateau of stock prices, who was given bad press because of that, came up later with some very, very good fundamental economic theories that are still being used. Ben Bernanke supports them completely, so the ones he came up with later. And one of the things he came up with it is a term called debt deflation.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in good times is corporations and people and the government accumulate a lot of debt. And they accumulate a lot of debt betting on good times continuing to come. And
because they always do, right? Good times are forever,
but there's
right?
There's a hiccup somewhere along the road. When you get to a certain load of debt, there's a hiccup somewhere along the load, a road, and you have to borrow money to cover your borrowed money.
Mm-hmm. Things start getting tough.
That starts a cycle that pulls money out of productivity, pulls money out of business investment. Well, what are we seeing? It pulls money out of good investment in the economy. And what happens then is that we get into a death spiral.
I don't know if we could call a recession a death spiral. We can definitely call it a spiral downward.
He says until enough of that debt is relieved through bankruptcy or paid off, that we can begin to grow again. And that's how he explained economic cycles.
It's why Japan stopped growing. They just accumulated so much bad debt that they couldn't – there wasn't enough money to be loaned to cause more expansion.
And why – let me explain one of the factors that's not in Irving Fisher's theories – but definitely is going on. Since 2015, there has been an increasing cash flow from individual investors going to bond funds. It's been accelerating. Last year, there was a lot more money went from into bond funds than into equity funds. Despite the fact that we had a bull market last year and a tremendous rise in the market last year, there was a net outflow from equity funds into bond funds. Well, what does that mean? People are fleeing to safety. But here's the problem with that safety. The typical, according to Morningstar, the typical, or the average, the median U.S. bond with a 6.53 year maturity, which isn't very far, is trading at 107.5. What does that mean? That means over the next 6 years, between now and the time that that bond matures, it's going to lose 1% a year or more simply because it's overpriced. It's priced above its par value.
Right.
So there's a built-in loss that people are going to absorb somewhere down the road, and they're not going to like it when they absorb that loss.
And you may actually make a profit on the interest. So don't get us wrong there. You may make a profit long-term on the interest, but you lose money on the maturity, and you still have to pay income taxes on the interest. Even though you're going to make a loss at the end, that's a different kind of loss. And we're about out of time for this hour. Man, there's a lot more to talk about on that subject. If you would like to call us off the air, we actually do give individual fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth. The phone number to call off the air locally is a voicemail.
254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. And on that page, we have newsletters, recordings of the radio program going back a long ways. We've got our philosophy and our method of doing business. Our beautiful staff and our made-for-radio faces are on there as well. We give you apologies in advance on that. We really enjoy this radio program. We've been doing this for – I've been doing it for 22 years now. You've been doing it for 23 years now.
We enjoy talking to phone balls.
And to each other. This is probably the longest we get to talk to each other all week long. And until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
And
thanks for listening.
Still is.
We appreciate the listeners and the time.